From the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our relationships with it. I'm Chris Cherniak.
And I'm Claire Wiley, filling in for Nell Larson. Now, in the first part of today's show, we have Pete McBride, who's going to be joining us. He's an acclaimed National Geographic photographer and filmmaker who works to protect freshwater and rivers with an emphasis on the Colorado River. And he'll be coming to speak at the Jim Santee Auditorium on Tuesday, April 25th, in an event titled Chasing Water, a community climate conversation with Pete McBride. The event is being hosted by the Park City Community Foundation's Climate Fund. And in addition, E.E. Hsu from the Park City Community Foundation Board is going to be joining us to provide some additional details about their climate fund, which they launched not too long ago.
Then, in the second part of the show, we'll talk sagebrush and the sagebrush sea with Matt Cahill. He works for the Nature Conservancy and is the director of the Sagebrush Sea Program. Now, sagebrush once stretched across almost 500,000 square miles from the Dakotas to California, but due to various factors, including development, agriculture, and climate change, the sagebrush sea has dwindled to half its historical range. To protect what remains, the Nature Conservancy has launched the Sagebrush Sea Program. We'll speak with Matt about what this program is all about, why it's so important to both the ecosystem, heck, and us. All that, and if we have some time, I want to give people an update on, hey, it's litter season, trash season. You know, once
the snow melts, starts to melt, yeah,
all the garbage suddenly surfaces, the flotsam and jetsam of our bad behavior.
Yeah.
And so Recycle Utah offers those little litter grabbers. So I'm going to give some details on how you can borrow one and help clean up this place.
Fantastic.
Environmental awareness and education, that's what This Green Earth is all about. Stay with us.
And you are listening to KPCW Park City, and this is This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our impacts upon it. And today, we have a very special guest. We have Pete McBride with us today, and he is coming to speak on April 25th. And we also have a Park City Community Foundation board member, E.E. Hsu, here to tell us a little bit more about that event.
Thank you so much, Claire. Thank you so much, Chris. Well, as you all know, Park City Community Foundation addresses some of the most challenging issues in our area, and one of our most important initiatives is climate change. Mm-hmm. The Climate Fund provides a critical piece of this climate puzzle by ensuring that local resources are in place so that we can implement impactful solutions to the community. So on April 25th at the Jim Santee Auditorium, we will have National Geographic Pete McBride here to talk about water and his journey through the Colorado River. It's an incredible presentation. We're really excited about that. And in tandem, we're going to be announcing some great news about the Climate Fund. So I'm not going to tell you now, but this is a little bit of a teaser to it. But we're really excited about the future of the Climate Fund.
And can people still get tickets to this?
Well, we were surprised because the event, well, sold out really quickly. So there is a wait list. So if you are still wanting to get tickets to that event, please go to parkcitycf.org to be on the wait list. I know many of your listeners to This Green Earth, they probably have tickets to this event. So just a reminder to those listeners who have tickets, if you want to be entered into a drawing for Pete's newest book, please carpool or take the bus, and you'll be entered into that drawing, and it's incredible. So we're really looking forward to April 25th.
And we are lucky enough, and if you didn't get tickets, that we get a little bit of a preview here on This Green Earth, and we are super excited that we have Pete McBride with us this morning. Pete, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Yes, we're glad that you joined us this morning. And Chris, you want to do a quick intro for him one more time, and then we'll kind of dive into what you're going to be talking about here in Park City and also your latest book.
Well, Pete McBride is an acclaimed National Geographic photographer and filmmaker who, among other things, works to protect freshwater and rivers with an emphasis on the Colorado River. And, of course, he's going to be coming here on the 25th to give a talk titled Chasing Water, a Community Climate Conversation with Pete McBride. So, Pete, let's start here. When did you get started in your involvement, say, well, with environmental issues and eventually the Colorado in particular?
I think I've always had an interest in the environment, but a few years ago, that's now actually over a decade ago, I did a story for National Geographic following the length of the Colorado River. And when I crossed into Mexico in a pack raft, the river had dwindled down to just a little trickle. And to my amazement, the river just ended just basically not even a mile into Mexico. And it used to travel another 100 miles through this very vast desert estuary. It was once the largest in North America. Hmm. And I was just floored. I just couldn't believe it. I mean, the river just sort of withered into this frothy pit of flotsam and plastic and garbage and who knows what. And that was it. The architect of the Grand Canyon, we had basically run dry. And I didn't know about this. And I grew up in the headwaters of the river in Colorado in the Rocky Mountains and figured I should have known better. But I think most of us don't know this. And so I think it really kind of rechanged my focus on my stories I wanted to tell and realized we need more stories on our changing world and lifelines like the Colorado River.
And is this when you decided to embark upon that journey?
Well, I was doing the source to sea journey for that assignment. And it was at the time really a small assignment. And I really decided that it was a much bigger story. I was going to stick with it. And I have since stuck with it. It seems like the river has called me back time and time again. So at that point, I walked the Delta, all 100 miles of it, a very thirsty affair. And then I've since gone back and actually paddleboarded it during a very rare pulse flow.
Right.
And my colleagues and I, we became the last people that were able to actually paddle the river all the way to the sea, which I say more sadly than proudly, because it was just down there recently and it's just as dry and cracked and thirsty as it has been. And a lot of people actually are like, oh, isn't this big, wonderful winter we've had, this snowpack that's, you know, been all over the West from you guys in Utah to here in Colorado and California, isn't that going to fix it? And I just want to make people realize that this has been a 20-year drought. At a certain point, we need to start really framing it as a changing climate, a hotter and drier climate. And one above average snowpack is not going to fix a 20-year deficit. And so it's we have a long way to go. And I've heard people say that we would need 3 complete full snowpacks, 3 years of above 100% snowpack without any consumption of the river to bring it back to what it was. Oh. So we have a ways to go, sadly.
Right. And describe what you mean by the way it was. What would that look like?
The way it was. So for those that aren't totally familiar with the Colorado River, it starts up in Poudre Pass in the Rocky Mountains, basically all of central Colorado. And it goes 1,450 miles, crosses 7 states. It picks up all the tributaries in Utah and even New Mexico, Arizona, California. And then it crosses into 2 countries, really. It covers into Mexico. And it used to create this 3,000 square mile desert estuary that Aldo Leopold went through there in a canoe in 1922. And he described it as a river it was nowhere and everywhere. Like you couldn't figure out which way to go because it fanned out and spread out so much. And there was so much biodiversity and so much wildlife down there and so many birds, migratory birds moving through that there was description of the sky turning black with birds. Mm. And pretty amazing. Cottonwood forest, even jaguars. And so it was really the kind of the library, the sanctuary of life, of biodiversity and one of the greatest fisheries down there as well. And so that's what it was for roughly 6 million years. And since the late 90s, we've dried it up. And now it's basically an agricultural section. And then most of it's just sort of this dry, cracked, very salty, uninhabited, kind of weirdly empty, quiet, dead landscape.
Right. I mean, it's you know, sometimes ecosystems can adapt and build some resilience to a changing environments. But it sounds like in this case, it's the biodiversity there or the biology there in general is absent.
I would say that there is probably still some. There's a tiny little bit of the estuary over on the very western flank in the Sonoran side that is basically fueled with water, the contaminated irrigation water that's too salty, too saline to put on crops. And that was an accidental estuary. Contaminated water was just dumped down there to get rid of it, basically. And it basically let nature do what nature does. And it brought back this tiny little estuary there that's now full of birds. It's kind of the last resting place for some 200,000 migratory birds that pass through there annually. And I was just there, and it's amazing. I had a beautiful encounter with an owl at night, and I heard endangered species of birds like the clapper rail. Birds I didn't even know, I've never seen. And so there is, I think if, you know, nature can rebound, and I've seen it rebound down there if we give it a chance. We've just basically, as I've heard someone say, we see the sins of our water management, our past water management in the West, in the Delta today.
And again, like you say, Pete, this record-breaking snowpack, at least for the state of Utah, perhaps other states have experienced way above normal snowfall this winter. That's not going to solve the problem because there's so many reservoirs and lakes that have to, and the soil itself and groundwater that has to kind of take its share of water first, before, you know, that part of the end of the Colorado gets its share.
Yeah, it's what people need to understand is groundwater and rivers and soil, they're all connected.
Right.
And so this record snowpack is tremendous, and it's great to see. It was, you know, awesome skiing, still is awesome skiing. Where I am in Colorado, I'm sure for you guys too.
Mm-hmm.
The groundwater and the water table is so dry and so depleted that I've heard studies now that even 100% snowpack translates to a 50% runoff.
Right.
Because the soil is just soaking it up. And in addition, our summers are actually hotter and drier, and in the past they've been longer. So plants start sipping on water much earlier. And then we have, where we are in Colorado, we have this phenomenon of dust on snow. Increased development to the west creates these snowstorms that come in the spring. We just had a big event, and it makes all our snow brown. It snows this kind of very dusty snowstorm, and all that dust particulate holds the sun's temperature, and it melts it off much faster. And so runoff is also a relationship with how quickly the runoff happens. If we get dust on snow events and a very quick, sudden, hot runoff, the soils can't absorb it, so it flushes off. And that may fill some of the reservoirs, but it's not filling the groundwater as well either. So it's a complicated science. And also, just so people understand, the two largest reservoirs in the United States are Lake Powell and Lake Mead. And I just was at both of them, and they are below 25% full. They're at around 22% full.
Wow.
So these are our bank accounts, which we've been pulling on and sipping at for the last 20 years. And so 1 year is it'll bring it up, hopefully, but it's not going to bring it up 75% each. No. There's just absolutely no way. And then there is also the issue that we have a math problem on this river where we basically believe there's more water in the system than there is. So we've allocated more straws than there is water. So it's an overallocation problem as well.
And for those of you that are just joining us, we are speaking with Pete McBride, and he is an acclaimed National Geographic photographer and filmmaker who works to protect freshwater and rivers with an emphasis on the Colorado River, and that's what we've been talking about. And you're talking about, you know, we have had on our Utah Snow Survey person just last week, and we were talking about we were at such a deficit that this winter, you're right, isn't going to make the difference that maybe some people think it is. But right. when you go on these journeys, Pete, and you absorb this and take this in, and then you try to dispel that information to people, what are the takeaways and what is it that you want people to know about what is happening with our natural world? What are some of those takeaways that are important for people to understand?
I think the big takeaway for me is that we, especially in the West here and with freshwater, we have a bigger impact than we realize. The river is more strained, and it's, you know, often said it's the most loved and litigated dammed inverted river in the world. And so we need to become more engaged, more aware of how fragile and limited this resource is that basically sustains so much of the lifestyle and everything about the West that we know. But also that I've seen a lot of remarkable change in the system, and that is often because of a handful of people who did get engaged. And so it's easy to feel like with the news these days, there's just too much and it's too heavy and what can I do and it's too hard. And the reality is we can do a lot, and it just takes showing up and paying attention to what's happening, being a voice in your local community, whether with a conservation group or your water authority, educating yourself on it and realizing that this water does not come from the tap. It comes from that snowpack that we love to ski on and the rivers and creeks that drain it and so forth. So I think the key is to try to understand more and then also become more engaged.
And as Chris mentioned earlier, nature does have a resilience to it. And if we give it a chance, and it's something that kind of evolved, and we saw during COVID when we had the shutdowns, we saw a lot of this resilience. And during that time, it's my understanding that you had started this book and photographing the Seeing Silence at that time. Is that correct?
That is correct. And it was, it's the book that looks at soundscapes around the world from my travels during COVID and prior, and how important soundscapes are in nature, particularly in natural environments. And it's basically a way to talk about changing climate, changing world through a different lens, maybe less politicized, but also just trying to give a voice to nature and show how nature can often bat last, but nature has a lot to say too if we actually listen to it. And so it explores, it sounds like a crazy concept, but it uses my imagery, and then I pair it with writings about what I was hearing or how the soundscape has changed. And in most cases, it's become much noisier than we think. It's very hard to find silence in nature, and silence in this book I define as natural sounds. So natural sounds can actually be quite noisy, say if you're in a penguin colony and they're all gawking and squawking. So it's really a discussion of getting away from mechanized human noise and trying to understand how we've changed it on that landscape as well, that soundscape.
And do we think we learned something from COVID? Because we did have those moments of silence, and we did see some resilience and nature coming back. And
well, it was, yeah, it was filling in the empty edges that we weren't typically appearing in, like streets and neighbor and parks and such. Nature just kind of like, hey, there's no humans here. Yay, I'm gonna wander around.
And is it kind of like taking that step back? Or again, you know, I just asked you that question about the takeaways. When you were doing this book and you were going to these remote areas, what sat with you the most? What were some of these experiences that sat with you the most?
I'll give one experience which was profound, is that I'd heard about all this research up in the Arctic about whales and orca and how they were communicating more because the shipping noise and all the human noise had gone away. It was called the COVID was not fun for us humans, but nature was really loved it. It was the greatest period of quietude in recorded history, they say. And so species like the humpback whale and the orca were suddenly able to communicate with each other like they hadn't. And so I went and actually documented it and went up to the very tip of Norway during the polar night and actually was able to get in the water with some special permission with some scientists and see a family of orca fishing for herring, and was able to do recordings and hear them. And they weren't speaking louder, they were just speaking a lot more and were very chatty. And it was just remarkable to witness. It was like they had left the cocktail party and suddenly they could have a conversation. It was like, wow, we can fish together and we're not surrounded with noise. And they had stories of humpbacks. And humpbacks, historically, they say were able to communicate at different depths and different distances from, they say, as far away from the coast of California all the way to the coast of Japan. But the noise of shipping lanes and submarines and so forth have made that very complicated. So they had sightings of humpbacks that used to fish. They would watch them fish and bubble net fish up in Alaska with their babies right next to them. But they suddenly saw them fishing in different areas in the fishing lanes. And they would leave their babies on the shore because they could communicate and be like, I hear you, you're good, all good here, just stay by the shore. And so it just showed how quickly nature was adapting back to historical kind of communication patterns, because sound is critical for survival for so many of these species. And so being able to get in the water with the orca, and I actually had one male swim right up to me and then ping me with sonar, and sonar's kind of their visual tool. And I just felt this huge, tremendous thump in my chest. And I was like, wow, I just got the orca high five to see who the heck is in their fishing waters up here in the dark of Norway. It was pretty magical. It was almost spiritual.
Well, we got a few more minutes. I want to circle back to the event on April 25th. You're coming to town. The title of your talk is Chasing Water, A Community Climate Conversation with Pete McBride. We've been told it's sold out. So what can the audience expect for during this evening?
Well, I will share some stories about my work, literally chasing water in the Colorado River Basin, but elsewhere. I'll share some stories of silence, and I'll just, we'll have some fun too, some laughs. I'll share some of my misadventures. It's not all rainbows and unicorns when you're out trying to make beautiful imagery and tell stories on the front lines of climate change. So there's some laughs too, and I think it'll be a great event, and I'm really excited to, really honored and excited to be there. So I look forward to seeing everybody in person.
Well, if it's sold out, maybe there's room for a second show.
I think we're trying to recruit you.
You're happy to do it, Pete? Oh, boy. Okay. You heard it here. I did have one listener have a question for you regarding your trip down the Colorado. When did you take that trip, and what was the most harrowing experience during that?
Well, I did that trip originally in 2009, 2010, and that was source to sea, and that's when I walked the Delta. I went back in 2014 and paddled the Delta. In 2016, I walked the entire length of the Grand Canyon, some 800 miles. That was a very challenging, thirsty affair. and then I just came back from the Delta just a couple weeks ago, revisiting some of the restoration areas and trying to understand what's happening with agriculture and water. So it's been an ongoing source to see journey, we'll say. And most harrowing, there's quite a few. I think hopefully the person could come on the 25th, and I'll share some of them there.
Oh, you're going to keep those.
All right.
Okay.
The classic teaser.
Yeah. Well, and I was interviewing an artist once who said that when we think about nature, a lot of the times we think about being on top of it instead of a part of it. Mm. And with that whale story, that's what it sounded like to me, is that you found that we are a part of our world. It is a part of us, and that we're not just sitting on top of it.
Absolutely. I would actually add to it that I've heard many native cultures say that we're at the bottom of the pyramid trend, and we're brought here to learn from all of the species that are actually above us. So it's sort of the inverse pyramid, so to speak. And I think we can learn a lot from nature, especially if we listen and pay attention. And I think we're getting a lot of messages recently and currently.
Yes, we need more pinging from nature.
Yeah, a lot more pinging.
And tell us if, you know, a lot of people are going to be able to come to this event. We're excited to get together and see this with you. But if someone wanted to get your book or learn more about your journeys or see your documentary, how do they do that?
I have a website, which is my name, PeteMcBride.com. There's some info there. I'll try to make it more up to date. I do some social media. I have Instagram, and that's Pedro McBride. Have a Guatemalan grandfather. That's where that comes from. Mm. And then I did a documentary. I've done quite a few, but one is still streaming on Disney Plus under National Geographic, and that's called Into the Grand Canyon.
Mm. Great.
All right, Pete McBride, National Geographic photographer and filmmaker, who's going to be here in town April 25th in an event titled Chasing Water, a Community Climate Conversation with Pete McBride. Pete, thank you so much for joining us this morning on This Green Earth. And we look forward to meeting you on the 25th.
Thank you guys so much. I look forward to meeting you.
All right.
Thank you, Pete.
Welcome back to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about our relationships with and impacts upon the environment. I'm Chris Cherniak.
And I'm Claire Wiley, filling in for Nell Larson today.
And joining us in the second part of the show is Matt Cahill. He is the Sagebrush Sea Program Director with the Nature Conservancy, and he's here to talk about the Sagebrush Sea Program. Matt, thank you so much for joining us this morning on This Green Earth.
It's good to be here.
Thanks. The rest is easy. Well, I thought we'd start here, Matt. Let's get a working definition of what a sagebrush system is, and perhaps in some ways what it is not.
Sure. Yeah, and in many ways this is a problem that folks like myself and colleagues I work with, you know, struggle with in our daily lives of what exactly are we talking about here? Because it is so broad. I mean, mm-hmm. we are talking about basically the semi-arid rangelands, the space between the mountains that stretches from really the Sierra in California all the way to the Dakotas and from the Canadian border down to the Grand Canyon. This landscape that's defined by a treeless extent where sagebrush, a shrubby species of Artemisia, is a really common and characteristic plant species. And they're open, dry, rangeland types environments. And they look very different on the west side versus the east side, the north versus the south, but what they all share in common are this dependence on sagebrush as a keystone species, open qualities, and kind of the unpredictable rainfall and growing season conditions, which wildlife and native species in these landscapes contend with every year.
Is there kind of an elevation range to a sagebrush system too?
There is. I mean, it can be quite low in some of the valleys in Nevada. The elevation's high because of the way the Great Basin works, but you get down into these salt flat, the salt flat deserts. Think of like the areas near the Great Salt Lake, for example, where you really leave the sagebrush sea at its lower elevations. And then at higher elevations, it just grades right into the conifer forests up in the mountains. And you have these broad ecotones where the sagebrush communities kind of give way to juniper woodlands or pinyon pine forests. And then eventually you're in the ponderosa and conifer forests that really aren't sagebrush sea at all.
All right. So before we, quote unquote, came along, what was the extent of the sagebrush sea as it's described?
Yeah, I mean, I should say the name sagebrush sea, it's a poetic description, and it just sort of refers to,
right,
especially in undisturbed landscapes or what this biome used to be. You could go out into a landscape where nothing on the horizon looked different than just the blue-green shimmer of sagebrush, just carrying on epically, very much like the color and texture of an ocean. And it used to extend probably about 100 million acres more than it does today. There's about 250 million acres of sagebrush ecosystem today in various states of intactness. That's bigger than any state in the country, save Alaska, and it used to be more the size of Alaska. But it has shrunk over the last century or so through lots of stresses from development, wildfire, invasive species, kind of changes in woodland dynamics. And that's some of the challenges we're striving with today, is just how do we keep the sagebrush that we have still here today.
What plants, obviously sagebrush, but maybe other plants, more importantly, say insects, birds, animals, what is the typical ecosystem? How would you describe the typical ecosystem?
Yeah, and sure, at the risk of generalizing in a way that, say, right, a colleague in Montana might be like, you're describing Nevada. Yeah. You know, the broad principles are you have an understory of herbaceous plants, notably what we call large perennial bunch grasses, things like blue bunch wheatgrass or Idaho fescue. People are familiar with a few of these species that are long-lived. They produce enormous root systems, and they endure year after year, sometimes for decades, very long-lived grasses, with a strategy of just go slow and steady. And among those bunch grasses are usually a wide diversity of annual and perennial flowering plants, forbs, all kinds. Kind of remarkable just how colorful the sagebrush seed can be in May or June. It's one of the maybe better kept secrets of the biome. And then there's this overstory of sagebrush, which is a large, wolfy, as we like to describe it, kind of shrub, blue-green in color, extremely fragrant.
Yeah.
And the patterns of those plants, the bunch grasses, the forbs, and the sagebrush, they're a mosaic that really has a lot to do with fire and drought, water and resources.
Okay, so there's the setting. Let's first kind of just tick off the usual suspects of associated with what's impacting lessening the extent of sagebrush and perhaps the quality of a sagebrush seed.
Sure. You know, in many ways, it's the same story that we're contending with all over the country of, you know, death by a thousand cuts, and also the legacy of actions we took a century ago before we even had these scientific concepts of ecosystems or invasive species. And we're living with the legacies of some of those actions. So big pressures on the sagebrush seed are, in places, conversion to croplands, mm-hmm, where the soils are arable enough to grow crops, and so turning over the landscape. The biggest threat today over most acres is this dynamic of invasive annual grasses, notably cheatgrass or Medusa head. They've got quite evocative names that outcompete our native species and facilitate more frequent and much larger wildfires. And one of the problems with our native species is they haven't evolved to contend with disturbance that quickly. They're more of a slow and steady cohort of plants. These invasive annual grasses are much better at the speculative market of boom and bust. And so we're seeing from a lot of corners the changing of native sagebrush seed into almost monocultures of basically weeds driven by invasive annual grasses and then all of their friends introduced mostly from Eurasia. And then a third major problem we have is in higher elevations, actually a lack of fire is causing woodland species to encroach into the sagebrush. And so we're seeing rangelands basically convert into forests, which lose all the properties that we value in this system.
What role would you say that the climate change and just basically a warmer and at least out west, a drier world is having on sagebrush too?
Yeah, I mean, we're discovering that as we go, but it's certainly this has always been a dry and unpredictable landscape.
Right.
We joke that there's really no such thing as an average rainfall. Yeah. Some years it's very wet and some years it's very dry. Many parts of the range this year are very lucky to have a pretty robust snowpack, but that hasn't been the case in recent years. And what we're seeing in climate change is just that unpredictability is increasing. Droughts are more severe. And wildfires are becoming larger and more frequent. And so these pressures of less and less predictable precipitation are driving the dynamics of our invasives. And there's even thought that the higher carbon in the atmosphere facilitates annual species like cheatgrass to grow more vigorously. So literally we're fertilizing the atmosphere for some of these weeds.
I want to get back to the cheatgrass and such. You say it was introduced by humans. Surprise. What did they bring it here for a reason? Was it for as a source of food for cattle or so? Why did it get here?
Almost certainly not. I mean, cheatgrass and these other species that are like it, you know, they are very good at moving around.
So
I mean,
just
they probably evolved in our rangeland systems of the Middle East or Turkey, you know, to kind of be in that space of disturbance and livestock grazing. they came over accidentally, probably in feedstocks, and then just spread. And they're very good at spreading. Every year they produce an enormous amount of seeds. Those seeds are very sticky and they move around. Once they find a place to grow, they're guaranteed to grow and try to produce seeds. It's just their lifestyle to always, yeah, always make a bet on the next generation. And so probably introduced accidentally, spread just through disturbance, and now extremely widespread.
We're speaking with Matt Cahill. He's with the Nature Conservancy, and he's the director of the Sagebrush Sea Program. So, Matt, what, as director of the program, what is your day-to-day activities?
Sure, yeah. Our Sagebrush Sea Program, that's what the Nature Conservancy calls our kind of organization of all of our work in this biome. So we work in native seed restoration, trying to improve how we can grow desirable native seed plants from their seeds and have more of that seed, because there's enormous bottlenecks in having enough of the right seed in the right place. We work on ways of finding how to change livestock grazing dynamics, which is a major use of the system, so that the rural economies that depend on that kind of use of these lands can continue to sustain themselves, but we can also sustain and support native systems, native plants, natural systems. We do a lot in the policy space, working with federal agencies. This is a public land landscape. The Bureau of Land Management, the Forest Service, they manage most of the acres in this enormous landscape. And so helping those agencies as good partners to craft policy that, you know, weaves through the complexities of all of these different uses to try to find the right balance of resources for people, benefits for nature. That's my day-to-day, is kind of connecting my colleagues, working with partners in this restoration management and policy space so that we can collectively have a brighter future for this biome.
And it does say here, I was reading that 70% of the sagebrush sea is found on public lands, like you just said. And So it is very important that you are in close contact with those government agencies. And what does that relationship look like? And is it feel like it's moving in a positive direction?
You know, I do. And I throw a shout out. I have a huge amount of respect for folks who work in our federal land management agencies. These are really challenging jobs, basically asked to manage dozens of competing uses, figure out the right ratio of what and where, get it through proper environmental review, implement, support rural economies, support state governments. It's an enormous task. But I think we're seeing some really positive changes in the right direction of helping the agencies think about their work at a scale that we can actually implement. You know, we talk about millions of acres here. It's very glib to say a million acres, but that's the reality. We need to think about what we do a million acres at a time. And that requires us to be nimble, efficient with our time and money, and really build a lot of trust amongst the different interested parties so that the outcomes, the projects that we approve, the policies we create, nobody's gonna be happy with everything, but can we get most people what they need out of the system without compromising its existence, you know, for decades to come? So just a lot of conversations. Federal agencies are big, they're complex, they have many levels of leadership, and it's just a lot of talking. I mean, a lot of the work in restoration these days is building community and collaboration among people.
So in the few minutes that we have, how do you define success? Is it literally, in some ways, converting rangeland or cropland back to sage, or are there other elements to it?
Yeah, the vision that I'm subscribing TNC onto, and many partners and agencies are agreeing to, is this idea of defend the core, grow the core, which is sort of a mantra, but we're turning it into action. And what that means is, in defending the core, look for those landscapes that currently haven't been sliced and diced by development. They haven't been invaded by weeds. They're still native and intact. And do everything you can to keep those places as they are. So that involves ways that we try to prevent wildfire, ways that we permit uses and keep development out of those landscapes. So focus on preserving what's good, but then really put your energy and attention into the boundaries of those core landscapes and grow the core. So be efficient and be effective with the kinds of tools that we have to do native seed restorations, use herbicides to control invasive annual grasses, strategically remove conifers in places where you get a bang for your buck, and then, you know, decide on management priorities in landscapes that are far away from that core that are maybe a better use of money and support economic resources that those landscapes can still support, knowing that we can't restore every acre and we have to balance a bunch of uses. So, you know, my idea is focus on what's good, keep it good, put your money around that and try to grow it as best you can, and then look for compromises where people can get what they need in different parts of the landscape without sacrificing the big landscapes that are still intact today.
Right. Are you seeing, can you give us an example of some success stories, whether it's, you know, statewide or project-wide?
Sure. Well, you know, the sage grouse is a charismatic species, and there has been lots of conversation about the sage grouse over this last decade. And we have a lot of work to do. By no means are we out of the woods, so to speak, on conserving that species. But I do think one story that we are seeing success on is the way that states and agencies have built mitigation frameworks, basically agreements to try to minimize or steer away development pressures from really important landscapes. And the Bureau of Land Management right now is trying to find a way to make that mitigation concept really hold on public lands and make public lands part of the equation. And I think we're seeing some of the benefits there, where needed infrastructure like solar and wind development or energy transmission is being put in landscapes that they're already kind of fragmented. There is disturbance. Maybe it's a highway corridor. And we're looking to see that those agreed upon programs are steering that development away from, you know, a big undisturbed kind of wild landscape, even if it might have been the more convenient route to start on.
I think one of the things that struck me too, you know, obviously we live in a place that is very heavily populated with sagebrush. And
I thought you were going to say with people.
Well, also people encroaching on the sagebrush.
Right.
And, you know, like, you know, you spoke to, there's hundreds of species that depend on this. It is a collapse of ecosystems if we do not pay attention to this. But I always saw them as a very strong and hardy plant. It just seemed that way to me.
Right.
But in doing a little bit of reading here, it sounds like it talks about the very fragile seedling that it really is.
It's true. I mean, and that's the lesson we've had to learn over and over again. These big landscapes, they seem unbreakable. It turns out they're pretty fragile. It's easy to break an ecosystem. It's extremely hard to rebuild it.
Yeah, and that's my understanding now. And I think that maybe with anything else, Chris, we do love to educate on this program.
Sure, that's what we're about.
So, and just in learning more about our environment and what's happening around us, and that we make such a great impact on it. And I love what you just said about it's easy to break things down, but it's harder to build them back up. And
right.
So I think it sounds like we have done a lot of breaking and now we need to concentrate on the building.
Right. And Pete, just to supplement that, what benefits does a sagebrush ecosystem provide humans?
Sure. I mean, well, there's the inherent value of natural systems and the wildlife and native species that live in them. Those have cultural values to people who've been here for a very long time, our
right.
Native American tribes and friends. These landscapes are used for economic resources like livestock grazing or recreation, which in many rural communities is the predominant way that people pay their mortgage and send their kids to college, is income earned off of those types of economies. And then, you know, wide open spaces, the kind of idea of what the American West is a value that we all kind of hold and cherish, the ability to get out into a quiet space and see a dark sky. There's also what a native intact system prevents. And speaking of people who live in this system, you know, downtown Salt Lake City or downtown Boise gets choked with wildfire smoke when big mega fires break out in the sagebrush sea. And those fires are often driven by this invasive annual grass cycle.
Right.
They're less common in native systems. And so if we can kind of restore and keep this system healthy, it also means cleaner air and better living conditions for people who maybe don't think of themselves as living in the sagebrush sea, but are very much affected by its dynamics.
And so if someone wants to get involved and to help maybe with this or to learn more about this, what's the path they should take?
Sure. I mean, to some degree, just learning about the sagebrush sea, it's a often overlooked system despite being enormous and beautiful in many people's backyards. So learning about the land between the mountains, I think, is a great start. There's lots of nonprofit organizations, including the Nature Conservancy, but also land trusts or other local NGOs that offer volunteer opportunities to get out and do hands-on restoration work, be that helping make landscapes more suitable for sage grouse or working in our very valuable streams and restoring our streams with low-tech restoration methods. And then just knowing about your federal agencies, and honestly, my opinion, supporting those agencies. They're hard jobs. And being kind of a good citizen and showing up, giving your opinion with these agencies, but helping them get proactive work done. We throw a lot of stones, and we don't need to. There's not enough time. We got to work together.
And the Nature Conservancy website is?
If you go to tnc.org/sagebrushc, you'll get to our website that talks about all of our work that we're doing in this system.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much, Matt.
Matt Cahill. He's the Nature Conservancy's director of the Sagebrush Sea program. Matt, thank you again for joining us this morning on This Green Earth.
Thank you so much for having me.
I want to mention the fact that, obviously, hey, yay, the snow is finally melting. I'm all for that.
Are you?
Yeah, because I want to see sagebrush.
Mixed feelings. I have mixed feelings about it, but right. I know a lot of people are ready for the spring awakening.
And yes, and things are going to be pretty wet. But in addition to the water we may see in and around town, there is a tremendous amount of trash and garbage that seems to magically accumulate over the winter, hide in the snow. How does it get there? I don't know. But it was suddenly when the snow melts, there is bottles and plastic and cans and such. And so it's time to... yes, clean that up in one way or another. And Recycle Utah has a nice little opportunity for all of us to share in that cleanup. They have little litter picker-uppers, for lack of a better word.
The technical term is litter grabbers. I have no idea.
Okay. Litter we'll trash grabbers. You know what we're talking about. And Recycle Utah will gladly allow you to rent one, as Carolyn Walrus says, rent one for free. Otherwise, borrow it for a period of time, short period of time. Get it, take a few, take you and the kids or whatever, friends, and go out. Hey, and why you say walking the dog and picking up its poop, by the way, you can also pick up some trash. And it'll be great for the environment. And it's I enjoy it because I feel good about it,
yeah,
too.
You can feel good, but I do agree with you, Chris, that it is a great activity to get the family involved and also to teach the kids about taking care of their things and that things don't disappear when you throw them on the ground.
Exactly. particularly plastics and metals, they are there for a long, long period of time. So, Recycle Utah has a limited number of these litter grabbers. You can go there and ask if you can borrow one and bring it back. And they're also going to be hosting some cleanup events. You can go to their website and learn more about that.
Yeah, we've got Earth Day coming up, so it's the perfect time to really get in tune with what's happening in our community and how you can help and be a part of it.
All right, well, let's wrap up. First, I'll thank Matt Cahill again, the Nature Conservancy's Sagebrush Sea Program, Sagebrush Sea Program Director, talking about sagebrush today. Thanks, Matt.
Absolutely, and we were thrilled to have on Pete McBride, who is an acclaimed National Geographic photographer and filmmaker who works to protect freshwater and rivers with an emphasis on the Colorado River. He has been around the planet. He has been in some of the most remote places in the world, and he is going to be giving a talk on April 25th at the Jim Santee Auditorium. If you did not get a ticket, unfortunately, it is sold out, but you can also go to his website and check him out and his book. I think it's PeteMcBride.org, or go to his Instagram. It's Pedro McBride, and learn more about his...
And there is a waiting list or so. You can still perhaps get sign up on the waiting list. I think you can go to the Park City Community Foundation's Climate Fund page and find out about how you can get on the waiting list.
All right. Absolutely. Yes, and that is a program brought to us by the Park City Community Foundation's Climate Fund. You can email us your thoughts, comments, and ideas for topics and stories. We definitely welcome those. You can email thisgreenearth@kpcw.org.
And the interviews for this show will be posted on the KPCW website later today. Thanks again for joining us. And remember, this is KPCW 91.7 FM Park City.